Boyd turned the Humvee down a suburban street lined with dark houses, drawing closer to their target. All the yards were covered in wildflowers and tall grass. "Almost there," he reported. "Just remember, the beasts out here might be nothing but normal, dumb variants, but when they're hungry, they're desperate, and we're the snacks," Ruckley said. Wong leaned forward in his seat and clapped Boyd on the shoulder.
"Some of us are more than just snacks." "Not going to let a variant get close to me," Boyd said, slowing the Humvee as they entered the neighborhood. "You know how fast you need to beat outrun a hungry variant?"
Wong rolled his eyes.
"How about you, Private Temper?" Boyd asked.
"Don't have any idea. I shoot them."
Boyd laughed.
Good answer. But the real answer is you don't have to be fast. You just have to run faster than your buddy. And I happen to know Wong is slow as shit."
The Humvee slowed in front of a house with broken windows. "All right, boys, get your shit together, because it's serious from here on out," Ruckley said. "Remember, recon only. Got it?"
"Yes, Sarge," Timothy said.
Boyd and Wong each nodded. The humor they used to mask the fear and tension disappeared. Ruckley opened her door first and slipped out into the night. Boyd and Wong went next, followed by Timothy. Each flipped down their night vision goggles. The humid night air brought with it a cool breeze. Not nearly as cold as it had been in the northeast, but Timothy still shivered. He tried to pretend it was just due to the wind, but he knew better. Ruckley signaled for Wong to take point, and Boyd fell in on rear guard. They carried their weapons at the ready as they walked down the middle of the street. Much of the road was covered in mud, splashing under their boots. Vegetation grew along the exteriors of the abandoned houses, with mold and mildew creeping up the sides. The sight was a reminder that Houston had been built on swamps and marshland, and nature was quick to reclaim civilization. Wong paused at a T-intersection. He gestured for them to take a left down a street where half the houses were nothing but blackened beams and a few lone walls. Trees sprouted from what had once been living rooms, showing this fire had been years ago, likely during the First War. Wind rustled over the structures and rippled the blades of overgrown grass. Timothy kept his rifle pressed tightly against his shoulder. While the other soldiers wanted to avoid the beasts, he wanted to find and kill them. The more dead variants, the faster the war would be over, and then maybe he could have a life. Maybe even with Tasha. He thought of her as he walked, recalling the moments they had managed to steal away together on Galveston. Soon he would be back to the island, and with Horn gone, he didn't have to worry about her dad breathing down their necks every second. The team continued through the street, prowling through the darkness. They found no animal carcasses or misshapen footprints in the mud or grass, nothing that would indicate any monsters had been here recently. Wong took them down another boulevard into the second neighborhood they were assigned to clear. The once picturesque street was lined with the arching branches of southern live oak trees. A light tapping noise made Timothy halt. Wong continued forward, but Ruckley stopped.
"What?" she asked.
He listened, but heard nothing. Maybe he was just being paranoid. Then he heard the tapping again. He held up a fist. Wong and Boyd stopped and crouched. Timothy pointed to his ears, then started a hand signal when a shape burst from the grass, exploding toward them. All four of them spun, but not fast enough. Before Timothy could fully understand what had happened, Boyd was down on his back. On top of him was a skinny variant with gray flesh and dilated vessels pulsating over its muscles. Boyd swung his wrist up to block a snapping bite from the variant, then let out a cry of pain as it ripped into his flesh. Timothy rushed forward, letting his rifle fall on its sling. He could not risk taking a shot, and instead, he took out his knife and threw his shoulder into the creature's exposed ribs. It reared up, and he jabbed the knife deep into its guts. The beast let out a pained squeal as Timothy dug the blade deeper, warm blood spilling over his hand. With a kick, he shoved the variant off Boyd. It scrambled back on all fours, facing Timothy, grotesque face drawn in an aggressive snarl. Timothy put himself between Boyd and the starving abomination. A suppressed shot burst through its forehead a moment later. Two more shots tore into its chest, and the monster crumpled. Ruckley stepped beside Timothy, aiming her M9 down the street.
"Thanks, Timber," Boyd said.
He winced, holding his bleeding wrist.
"Quiet," Ruckley said. "Might be more."
Wong swiveled on his heels, rifle roving over the empty lawns. No other creatures howled or pounced from the tall grass. Timothy knelt next to the fallen monster to check out something around its neck. He reached down to find a black collar like the one the collaborators had used on their thralls in Maine. Boyd and Wong appeared confused, but Ruckley knew exactly what the collar represented. Somewhere to their south, they heard more rustling grass and another growl.
"Quick," Ruckley whispered. "Get to cover."
Wong helped Boyd up, and they sprinted the opposite direction, running straight for a house toward the end of the street. Timothy was the last one inside, his boots splashing over soggy, mildew-covered carpet. He followed the team upstairs where they spread out inside a bedroom with broken windows. They each took a spot along the wall, and Timothy snuck a glance out the window while Wong helped Boyd clean and bandage the bleeding wound from the variant bite. The scent would draw the beasts if they didn't hurry.
"Command, Recon Sigma 1," Ruckley whispered over the radio. "We have multiple contacts. Stand by for location."
"Copy, Recon Sigma," replied the operator. "What's your location?"
Ruckley looked at Wong.
"Riverbend North, Nails Creek," the Houston native whispered.
Ruckley relayed the answer. Outside, the sound of gruff voices grew closer, along with another howl. Timothy went still, and Ruckley turned off the radio, silently observing the unfolding scene. Another variant ran to the dead one. It paused at the corpse, sniffing at the dead monster, then looked back over its shoulder, teeth bared. Cranking back its head, it let out a short howl. Timothy expected to see collaborators emerge from the grass with a remote control like Nick and Pete had possessed at Mount Katahdin. Sure enough, three humanoid shapes walked out carrying rifles. But these weren't men. The hybrid beasts had scything claws protruding from the ends of their fingers, and their faces were flat and scarred with golden eyes. They were chimeras, deadlier than normal variants and collaborators. These were the infamous scions of the new gods, the ultimate combination of man-made science and Mother Nature's evolution. And now they were just outside Houston. 4. Beckham finally had a chance to grab some shut-eye in the outpost Houston apartment he and Kate were given, when frantic knocking jolted him awake. A glance out the window showed it was still dark. Maybe 3 or 4 in the morning, if he had to guess. Kate turned over in bed, planting her feet on the floor.
"Wonder who it's for this time."
Together, they wandered toward the front door and opened it. Outside was a big red-haired man with a shit-eating grin.
"Morning, boss,"
Bighorn said with a yawn.
"You'll never guess what the cat dragged into Houston."
"Guess it's for me," Beckham said. "You can go back to sleep, Kate. You need it."
"I'm already awake. Might as well go back to work."
She disappeared back into the bedroom to change.
"What's going on?" Beckham asked Horn.
"We found some enemy scouts."
All the exhaustion and stupor of being woken up in the middle of the dark early morning hours disappeared in a blast of adrenaline. It took only a couple minutes for Beckham to slip on his ACUs, grab his rifle, and say goodbye to Kate. He followed Horn down the stairs from the apartment to the street where three Humvees waited. Beckham hopped into the back of the lead vehicle with Horn, and they took off.
"Where are these scouts?" Beckham asked.
"I'll let her explain,"
Horn said, nodding to a soldier in the front seat. Rico turned to look at him, a shock of pink hair poking out from below her helmet.
"Good to see you, Captain. I've been up all night helping with security detail."
Then she pointed at the driver, a man with sandy blonde hair.
"This is Corporal Max Lindquist. He'll be on Team Reaper for the rest of the morning. We've been organizing tonight's scouting and security ops. Recon Sigma ran across some starving variants about 20 minutes ago.
"You got us up for that?"
Horn asked.
"Can't they handle some?"
"There are chimeras in the area, too," Rico said.
Beckham cursed under his breath. He had thought they might have a few more days to prepare the outpost for a potential attack. but hearing the beasts had come all the way down here to Houston dashed those hopes.
Ruckley's team tracked them to an encampment, Rico said.
So we're rolling in and carpet bombing them, right?
Horn asked. He rubbed his big hands together.
That's worth getting up before the ass crack of dawn.
No. Command wants one of them alive, Rico said.
Jesus. Command's never gonna learn, Horn said.
Rico ignored him.
Since we have so much experience in the field, Jacobs wanted you to lead tonight's snatch and grab.
You got a map of the area? Rico passed one back to Beckham. She leaned over her seat, circling the neighborhood where Ruckley had last reported their location and the Chimera encampment.
Tell Ruckley to maintain her position, Beckham said. The four of us in this Humvee are Reaper. Humvee 2, Bravo. 3, Charlie.
He laid out on the map where he wanted each Humvee to park and how they would approach the encampment to give each team clear firing lanes while surrounding the Chimeras. Rico relayed it over the radio. After another 15 minutes of driving, they pulled off the highway and wound through roads littered with abandoned cars. The other two Humvees peeled off down separate roads. They killed their headlights, and Lindquist pulled down his night vision goggles, slowing so the engine noise didn't give away their position. When they finally parked behind a two-story house for cover, Beckham got out first, stepping out onto the pavement with his prosthetic blade. He dropped low immediately, signaling for Horn to take rear guard. Rico and Lindquist took the flanks, and together they prowled through the overgrown grass like sharks after prey. They followed a creek, staying close to the grass for cover. According to the map, the waterway should take them straight to the camp. If they had timed everything right, they would converge there the same time Bravo and Charlie did. Then, with the help of Recon Sigma, they would ambush the Variants and Chimeras. As they approached the target, Beckham paused. A park with a rusted playground and several picnic shelters protruded from the unkempt weeds. At one of those shelters, he noticed three Chimeras talking and sharing food. Even from his vantage behind a thicket of trees and bushes, Beckham could hear the tearing of flesh and meat. He counted another four Variants circling eagerly around the Chimeras, waiting for a morsel.
Where were their lookouts?
He didn't see any scouts or guards. The Chimeras were smarter than this. Rico knelt beside him, with Horn and Lindquist watching their backs. Across the park, in another backyard lined with trees, Beckham noticed four infrared tags in his NVGs. That was Bravo. To the east, he could see the IR tags glowing from Recon Sigma's NVGs from their position near an abandoned RV. He didn't know which one, but one of those tags represented Timothy. He knew the young man would be fighting Variants again, but the thought of him facing even the deadlier Chimeras filled Beckham with dread. Toward the west, he studied the lines of trees next to a pond. That was where Charlie was supposed to be, but no IR tags glowed. Maybe the team was just slower or ran into some unexpected obstacles. But the fact that a Chimera and two Variants were missing too was not a good sign. Beckham considered breaking radio silence to get a sit rep, but making any noise now so close to the enemy could ruin their cover. Each second without seeing Charlie passed as its own agonizing eternity. The other team had to be out there. No one had called for assistance or reported any issues. He hadn't heard any gunshots either. Another 2 minutes passed. Horn suddenly pointed as two Chimeras appeared from between a couple houses. Each lugged a body over their shoulders. A pack of Variants followed on all fours, snapping and snarling at each other. Then came a second pair of the hybrid soldiers with two more human prisoners. Beckham took his binoculars from his tack vest and pulled them up to his eyes, zooming in for a better look, confirming his worst fears.
Son of a bitch, that's Charlie team, he said quietly.
The Chimeras carrying the dead soldiers dumped them on the ground, and the Variants dove in for the feed. The two surviving Charlie soldiers squirmed to get away. One thrashed himself free from the grip of a Chimera, only to have his throat slashed. The Thrall Variants surrounding the shelter dove into the fresh corpses, teeth and claws ripping into the dying soldier.
We have to do something, Rico said.
The Chimeras tied up the last surviving soldier to a post of the shelter. Horn wedged up next to Beckham with his M249 saw, ready to let some lead fly.
Let me at him, boss.
One Chimera stuck its nose into the air, freezing, bloody entrails still dripping from its mouth. It sniffed, then signaled to the other monsters. The starving thralls even stopped feeding for a moment. Beckham knew this was their only chance to save the final survivor of Team Charlie and capture a Chimera, but it would put them all at risk. A long moment passed, the tension nearly palpable as his team looked at him for orders. He squeezed the call button on his radio.
All teams go.
Horn practically jumped up to fire, tracer rounds splitting the darkness. The beasts scattered in all directions. Reaper pushed forward through the tall grass, disappearing into the foliage. Beckham looked for the telltale shifting of blades that would show where the other variants were. He listened for the clicking joints or growls. A deep boom shook the ground, halting Beckham. Horn stopped firing for a beat.
That came from Bravo's position, he said.
Gunshots barked from across the park, followed by the pained howl of a variant. Beckham pushed through the grass, his vision blocked by the foliage. He took the team closer to the creek that they had initially followed. That was when he felt it. A slight tug on his prosthetic like he'd run into a fishing line, providing just a modicum of resistance. Then he heard a whir, like a spring releasing.
Get down! He roared.
Beckham dropped to the ground, Rico diving next to him. Horn threw himself down onto the edge of the stream. Lindquist was too slow. A bounding mine launched from where it had been planted, spraying shrapnel in a wide disc about 5 feet off the ground. The shrapnel cut into Lindquist's arms and chest, tearing into his neck. He didn't have time to scream before his body hit the ground. Almost as soon as the mine exploded, Beckham heard a roar to his left and rolled just in time to bring his rifle up. A variant burst from the grass, claws extended, sucker lips popping. A trigger pull peppered the beast with 3 rounds. Gunshots exploded around the park along with the roars of other variants. Horn pulled on Lindquist, trying to drag him to safety, but the man was dead, his head practically severed from his neck.
Leave him, Beckham said.
Chimeras are moving, Ruckley's voice burst over the radio. They're splitting up. Beckham's heart raced. This wasn't just a chance for the Chimeras to feed, it was a damned trap. Things were quickly falling apart and he couldn't help but think of Timothy. He couldn't let the young man die out here. Other voices over the radio cried for help, reporting more men down as the variants tore into the teams. Gunshots were interspersed with the boom of anti-personnel landmines. Beckham recalled Outpost Turkey Creek and all those other frontier outposts that had secured their lands against variant attacks using mines. Now those weapons were being used against them.
Reaper, Recon Sigma 1 here, Ruckley said. Variants headed your way.
Beckham stood, trying to watch for monsters and mines all at once.
Horn, Rico, on me, he yelled.
They advanced into the darkness, following the creek. Another 2 variants exploded from the grass around them. Rico shot one, and the second slammed against Horn. The big man clenched his fingers around the variant's neck as the beast snapped at him. He let out a roar, cranking back the creature's neck, followed by a resounding crack. The creature went limp in his grip and he dropped it to the ground. Rifle up, Beckham went into the clearing where the picnic shelters were. Toward their south, 2 Chimeras engaged in a gun battle with Bravo. Recon Sigma had descended from the RV and were at the edge of the park. He spotted Timothy next to Ruckley, both still alive and unhurt.
Thank God, Beckham thought.
Beckham spotted 2 Chimeras sprinting northward, straight toward his position. The ghastly soldiers saw him too, and brought up their rifles, firing. He threw himself to the side as bullets stitched the ground, kicking up a spray of mud. Another roar sounded behind them as variants pounced at Rico and Horn again. Beckham kept his focus on the Chimeras. He centered his sights on the first Chimera and pulled the trigger. Rounds punched into the half-man's chest, blood spraying out the exit wounds. The second beast leapt over the new corpse, firing wildly mid-jump. Beckham had to duck, pressing himself into the side of the creek as the Chimera retreated northward on the other side of the creek.
Chimera's down, a voice from Bravo reported. Engaging variants now!
That left this single running Chimera alive.
I'm going after him,
Beckham shouted as Horn and Rico battered a pair of variants. He ran as fast as he could, his prosthetic threatening to slip on the muddy shore. The Chimera turned back only to let off another series of wild shots. Beckham pushed harder, accelerating, but the creature was far faster. He stopped and aimed his rifle, aiming for a leg. The shot hit the back of its knee, sending the half-man tumbling. Beckham kept his rifle up as he approached. The Chimera tried to drag itself away. Pulling out his combat knife, Beckham ran toward the injured monster. The mutant creature turned and sliced with clawed hands as he approached, but he managed to drive the blade hard into his shoulder. The Chimera roared and slammed its skull into Beckham's nose, knocking off his night vision optics. Dazed, he fell back, warm blood oozing out of his nostrils. He tried to scramble away to give himself some room to recover. Footsteps sounded, followed by snarling and a crack. Vision blurred. Beckham pulled out his pistol and swung it toward the noise, ready to pull the trigger and kill the Chimera.
Boss, Horn yelled. Don't shoot!
The stars cleared, and Beckham saw his friend in the moonlight wrestling the Chimera on the ground. Rico joined them to help secure the creature. Timothy ran over a minute later, and relief swelled through Beckham when he saw the young man.
Area is clear, Timothy said, panting.
Beckham put a hand on his nose.
Damn, that hurt. At least it's not broken,
Horn chuckled.
Kate wouldn't be happy about that.
A little laughter was a good thing, but it didn't last. They had lost a lot of good soldiers tonight, and were returning home with fewer men and women to defend what was left of the Allied States. Azrael marched down the long corridor of the Citadel, the command center of the Land of the New Gods. Red tendrils of webbing covered the glass walls like oversized spiderwebs. Scions walked up and down the hall, and a few variants crawled between them, some traversing the walls or ceilings, using the webbing as handholds. Across the webbing, cocoons writhed, filled with prey the variants or his scions had brought back to feed the organic communication network. Azrael took his time admiring the ecosystem on his way to the throne room. Two scions bowed, then stepped aside so he could enter what had once been a lecture hall. In his past life, he had attended a multitude of scientific presentations here. This had been a place of technological prowess, a place where the greatest minds in the world had gathered to exchange ideas and build a brighter future for humanity. The atmosphere had changed significantly. Long ropes of webbing hung off the ceiling beams nearly three stories high. Two gigantic masterminds sat on either side of the stage at the back of the hall. Their massive pink bodies appeared like brains that escaped from enormous skulls. Tendrils stretched from their folds and into the network surrounding the throne room. All along the walls, scions stood guard, each with the face and gray flesh of a variant, but the burning intelligence of human beings behind their golden reptilian eyes. Azrael descended the steps to the stage, adjusted his black cloak, and took his seat at a throne made from the red vines of the organic webbing. Within the throne, a few humans were cocooned and imprisoned in the crimson tendrils, their low moans muffled by vines snaking through their mouths. Those insolent animals were now batteries for his network. It was all a fitting reminder that he alone was the greatest achievement of nature and science, a being who would literally and figuratively sit atop all these mortals. He created and altered life. Death was just one of his instruments. Yes, this place had once been a place of learning, the pinnacle of humanity's innovation. The labs within this facility had housed the development of some of humanity's greatest achievements and weapons. Now he had created the greatest one. It was only right that this place served as the capital to the new gods. He curled his clawed fingers around the armrest of his throne and surveyed the room. All the chairs that had once been lined in neat rows were covered by vines. The loud, gasping breathing of the masterminds filled the place, and their rotten stench swirled amid the odor of the vines. A skinny silhouette appeared at the entrance to the throne room. One of the human faithful.
Enter, Azrael said.
Murphy, an old doctor wearing a white coat, walked forward with a slight hunch. His fingers were crooked and knotted in arthritis, but still he dropped to one knee when he reached the throne.
Prophet, I'm sorry to disturb you, but I have news about the Northeast operation.
Azrael grunted in disgust at the memory of what had happened. The Northeast operation was supposed to have ended the war by launching the nuke from Mount Katahdin, but the former leader of the infamous Team Ghost and some other heinous traitors had managed to destroy the base and sabotage the weapon.
Speak, said Azrael.
Our Scion scouts discovered a survival at Mount Katahdin after the heretic sabotaged the base. He was barely alive when the airlift brought him here, but I managed to save him.
Save him?
Yes, Murphy said, his eyes finally rising to meet Azrael's. And I made him better. Really, I had no choice. His human body was too damaged.
Did you give him my latest version of VX-102?
Yes, Prophet.
Good. I want to see how well the new formula reacts to the human genome.
Murphy nodded and backed up slowly, never rising above his hunching bow until he had left the throne room. While Azrael was pleased with the old man's work, there was another who was responsible for this failure in the Northeast operation, whose work he had been less fond of.
Bring me the general,
Azrael rumbled, his words echoing in the vast chamber. The masterminds both quivered, their fingers twitching and curling, sending signals through the communication network. Minutes later, the general squeezed through the main entrance, bowing like the old man had. His cloak flowed behind him, and he kept his crocodile snout aimed toward the ground. The bulging muscles along his arms rippled against his flesh, and his massive claws scraped the floor with every step.
Prophet,
the Alpha variant said, his voice coming out in a choking rasp. He was a prime specimen of unrestrained evolution and adaptation, thanks to the impact of VX-99 on his body. His physique was that of a powerful predator, and his aggression on the battlefield had no match. But he was also a glaring example of why Azrael had worked so hard to better blend human intelligence with the body-altering epigenetic changes and the original bioweapons that had warped humanity. This creature had too many faults. He could barely choke out his own words, and now Azrael feared the general's mind wasn't as developed and intelligent as he'd once thought. Azrael had trusted this beast with a mission that he realized now was only truly suited for one of the new gods, one of his creations. Azrael stood from his throne and stepped down the short stairs from the stage to the floor where the general knelt.
You,
Azrael said, drawing closer. The general, still towering above Azrael even as he knelt, flinched.
It was Uran. Like a scared rat,
Azrael interrupted, keeping his voice calm.
You should have stayed and fought to the death like a wolf.
The general kept his head bowed.
I'm sorry,
Azrael snapped his fingers, summoning red tendrils along the floor that rose like cobras. The vines snapped around the general's wrists and legs. They pulled him into the air until he was suspended 3 meters off the ground.
The Allied States should already be ashes, and President Ringgold should be dead,
Azrael said. He let out a snort.
For nearly a decade I've been patient, living in the shadows while creating this new world, and now I have to wait longer.
He looked at one of the masterminds controlling the tendrils.
Tighter.
The webbing pulled harder on the general, and the monstrous variant groaned, his bones snapping, popping out of their joints.
You failed, despite all evidence that you should have succeeded,
Azrael said.
You defied every probability analysis I ran. It's as though you intended to lose. You sicken me.
Azrael looked at the other mastermind and made a simple waving gesture with his claws. Red tendrils wormed into the general's mouth and nostril, squirming through his body like parasitic worms.
His agonized scream was muffled by the vines stretching down his throat. Azrael snapped his claws again, and the vines retracted suddenly, letting the general's joints pop back into place. The monster fell to the ground, landing with a sickening smack, then slowly pushed himself back up to one knee, his huge chest heaving. Blood dribbled out of his nostrils. Azrael approached him, then put his claws under the general's long chin, lifting his face to catch his gaze.
"You will not fail me again, will you?"
"No, Prophet. I will die before I fail you again."
Each word came out forced, rasping. Azrael gestured to the two masterminds at either corner of the throne room.
"We have detected human interference within our network. They are trying to sabotage our communications."
"Let me find them," the general choked out. "Let me prove myself."
Azrael retreated to his throne.
"Yes, find these humans, and bring me Captain Reed Beckham," he said. "Or next time, I will pull off your limbs myself and feed you to the thralls."
5. The light snowfall came down more steadily over the wilderness outside Banff. Cold wind cut into Dohai's parka, finding every entryway to scrape over his flesh. His fingers were beginning to numb, and every breath of air seemed to freeze the inside of his lungs. He wouldn't let Mother Nature convince him to turn back, though. With the rest of Team's ghost and spearhead on his tail, he had only one singular thought. Follow the bears. They had to figure out why they were organizing, especially if someone was using them for an impending attack on the Canadian base. Dohai and the others were perched at the rim of the ravine, watching the bears follow a frozen stream nearly 20 meters below to the west. The beasts were heading directly northwest toward the Bow River.
"Where the hell are they going?"
Toussaint asked.
"No idea," Fitz whispered back. "That's why we need to follow them."
"I've been in this area long enough to tell you when a blizzard's coming," Doherty said. "Even the best tracker can't follow his prey when he's frozen solid under a 10-foot snowdrift."
"As much as I like solving mysteries, I like staying alive and killing bears more," Sherman said. "Let's just kill these ugly assholes and be done with it."
Dohai lifted his binos and stared as far down the ravine as he could see, trying to find some clue as to where the monsters were headed.
"Dohai, what do you think?" Fitz asked.
Nielsen was right, and as much as he hated to admit it, sometimes there was no advantage to being stubborn.
"The weather's going to make it impossible to follow them," Dohai said. "There's no point in going on."
"If we're calling off the pursuit, I'd rather take these beasts down tonight, so they're not tomorrow's problem,"
Nielsen said.
"Exactly,"
Sherman said.
"We didn't follow these guys all the way here for nothing. Let's make this count."
Fitz nodded.
"You've got a point, but damn, I really want to know what they're doing."
"Weather is shit, boss," Ace said. "We've got the jump on them now. Better than them ambushing our guys later."
"True, but..." "He's right," Dohai said. "We really should take them down now while we can."
The bears were still marching in a line at the bottom of the ravine against the unrelenting snowfall.
"Okay, let's do this quick, but safe, and then get our asses back to base," Fitz ordered.
"Ghost will run along the ravine to get ahead of the pack. Spearhead, you stay at their rear in case they turn tail. Radio silence from here on out until I give the go-ahead."
Dohai took off between the trees, taking the Delta Force operators slightly away from the ridge to stay out of the bear's sight. Once he judged they had run far enough ahead, he held up his fist. He, Fitz, and Ace then dropped low and crawled back to the edge of the ravine. Sure enough, the bears lumbered along next to the frozen stream nearly 100 yards away. Dohai peered down the lip of the ravine to see the IR tags from Spearhead's night vision goggles as they too watched from their vantage points nearly 50 feet up from the bears. Spearhead was about 20 yards to the rear of the monsters. Their positions would not get much better than this. The giant creatures had nowhere to hide along the stream, except for a few lone trees and large rocks, but even that shelter was too meager for the hulking monsters. Dohai raised his rifle and sighted up the first monster. Ace and Fitz mirrored his movements, each picking their targets. Everyone had already palmed in their magazines with armor-piercing rounds. It was their best and only shot of tearing through the thick hides of the beasts.
"Execute," Fitz whispered over the radio.
Dohai squeezed his trigger. Rounds lanced into the chest of the lead bear, punching into its flesh. The creature staggered. Other suppressed shots echoed from up and down the ravine as the operators joined in the fusillade, painting their targets with the AP rounds. The bear Dohai had shot stumbled forward when some more shots stabbed into its flank. But the big beasts were like walking battleships, huge muscled limbs covered in dense fur. They weren't so easily dispatched. The monster let out a vicious roar that rivaled the bark of gunfire, and its eyes found Dohai. It charged, opening a mouth full of curved fangs. Three more bullets crashed through its mouth and forehead, breaking through bone and puncturing one of its eyes. The monster tripped and slid through the snow, pushing up a mound, steam rising from the fresh holes in its still body. Fitz and Ace worked to take down another, and the Canadians began mopping up the monsters at the rear of the pack with headshots. Dohai found his next target and unleashed a few controlled bursts into the monster's side to get it to turn. Then he sighted the head and fired. The massive beast galloped on all fours straight for its attackers. Dohai managed to take down the creature, and it slid across the ice. Another bear leapt over its dead brethren, then scrambled up the side of the ravine. Packed snow gave way under its claws, and it slid back to the rocky bank of the creek. He fired again and again as the monster tried to barrel up the side of the ravine. A well-aimed round buried into an eye socket, and the creature collapsed, slipping back down over the ice, leaving a trail of crimson. The last two made it further up, their claws finding purchase in the rock and ice, pulling themselves ever higher and closer to Team's ghost and spearhead. They were nearly on spearhead, just a few feet from the lip of the ravine. In seconds, they would be within striking distance. Spearhead fired desperately at them, but the thick hide of the beasts slowed the damage being done to them. Desperation and rage fueled them. Dohai adjusted his aim, sighting up one of the monsters with blood dripping down its side. He fired at the skull and took off the jaw in the blast of rounds. It fell backward, crashing into the last creature. The two beasts tumbled back toward the floor of the ravine, cracking against rock on the way down. A final gunshot echoed and faded away. Dohai listened for the sounds of other howling variants in the distance, waiting to see if something else would attack in response to the commotion. He heard nothing except for the quiet of the falling snow.
"Clear,"
Nelson reported.
"Clear," Fitz said.
He waited a beat, then added,
"Let's head back."
The accelerating snowfall was beginning to bury the dead bears by the time Ghost caught back up to Spearhead.
"We aren't going to make it back up the way we came," Nielsen said.
Doherty nodded.
"Hiking straight uphill in a snowstorm like this is suicide."
"What do you propose?" Fitz asked.
"We can head north until we hit Bow River, then follow it back to base. It'll be a hell of a lot easier than trying to climb straight up the mountain, and it'll save us time."
"Sounds good to me," Fitz said.
They began their trek back toward Banff. Dohai checked his watch under his thick sleeve. By the time they made it back to base, it would be morning. They marched as fast as they could through the increasingly deep snow. Dohai's muscles burned with the effort to push through it. Nielsen had been right. If they had continued following the bears, they would have been stranded in the Arctic conditions. For another hour, they pushed through the ice and snow.
"Not too much longer," Nielsen said.
"Thank God," Ace said. "I gotta take a shit."
Dohai noticed something different about the path ahead. He held up a fist, and the team paused. Then he ducked down into a hunch and pushed through the snow about 20 yards through the trees toward the south. Ghost and Spearhead were not the only ones who had planned on following the river. In front of him, long swaths of snow had been pushed aside, as if a group of people had come marching through. Given the intensity of the snowfall, it hadn't been long since these people had passed. Dohai hurried back to join Ghost and Spearhead, lungs burning from the frigid air.
"What's up?" Fitz asked.
"Looks like someone was here," Dohai panted.
"Maybe. Maybe a group of 10 people or so.
Are there other patrols out here?"
Nielsen shook his head.
"Let me find out." He called Command on his radio. "Command, Spearhead 1. Are there other patrols in our vicinity?"
"Negative, Spearhead 1. All other units were recalled about an hour ago."
Dohai directed his NVGs at Fitz. Someone else was out there, and judging by the direction, they too were headed straight for Banff.
"Command, be advised, we found tracks," Nielsen said. "And they're headed your way."
"You're too exhausted," Leslie said. "Time to let someone else take over communicating with the network."
Kate groaned. She had only managed a few hours of sleep. When Beckham had been called to the field, she knew she had missed her chance at rest. Instead, she had gone directly back to the tunnel entrance in the Houston hospital just outside the outpost gates. Her staff was here now, too, and Leslie had taken the chair, ready to connect. Ron reluctantly held a writhing tendril of webbing at the back of her neck while Sammy watched. A team of soldiers stood guard over the research site, several of them watching.
"You don't have to do this," Kate said. "I'm fine, really."
"You can't be the only one," Leslie said. "Someone else needs to learn how to communicate with the network like you do."
Kate wasn't sure what the long-term ramifications of connecting to the network like this were, but inwardly she was glad Leslie had offered to help. All she knew was that each time she did, electricity seemed to pour through the vines of tissue and into her. From her basic studies, the tendrils acted like electrodes against the skin, reading signals passed between her nerves and sending electric signals back into her tissue as feedback.
"When I've learned, we can teach Ron too," Leslie said. "That way we all share the burden."
Ron looked to the side as if he wasn't sure about that.
"It's okay," Leslie said with a smile.
Kate couldn't help feeling protective over the slightly younger lab tech.
"When you're ready," Sammy said, "I can initiate the connection."
"Let's do it," Leslie said.
Sammy pressed a button on her keyboard, and the tendril went wild, adhering to the back of Leslie's neck. Leslie's eyes closed, and her face set in a grimace.
"Is she okay?" Kate asked.
Sammy nodded.
"This is exactly what happens to you each time we..."
Voices echoed down into the parking garage, and a few of the soldiers standing on guard perked, shouldering their rifles. Kate walked over to one of the guards.
"What's going on?"
One of the soldiers on guard put his radio to his ear.
"Sounds like Captain Beckham and the scout teams are back. They took some casualties."
"Is Reed okay? Did they say Captain Beckham was hurt?"
I don't.
Kate looked back to Sammy and Ron.
"Take care of Leslie."
"Wait, Dr. Lovato,"
the soldier said, running after her. Kate took the stairs two at a time, with the guard following. She didn't stop until she got to the hospital. Combat medics ran down the hall with soldiers on stretchers. Voices called out orders and requests for help. Ruckley and Timothy were the first familiar faces she saw. They were helping another soldier whose wrist was covered in bandages. A fourth soldier Kate didn't recognize was with them. Timothy caught her eyes as he helped his teammate into a chair where medics began examining his wounds.
"Beckham's all right," Timothy called to her. "Horn too. They're just behind us."
Kate didn't breathe a sigh of relief until she saw Beckham, Horn, and Rico enter a few seconds later with a prisoner. An entire phalanx of soldiers surrounded them, and she quickly saw why. The prisoner wasn't a collaborator. It was a chimera. Beckham limped away from the group when he saw Kate. He was covered in grime, smelling of sweat and blood, but she didn't care. They met in a long embrace. Horn joined them, wiping his face with the back of his big hand.
"How bad is it?" Kate asked.
6 of ours dead and 3 injured," Beckham said.
"How?"
Kate asked. "They set a trap," Beckham said, shaking his head.
"I don't understand," Kate said. "We haven't intercepted any messages that they were planning an attack on Houston."
"That's why we brought him here."
Kate watched as the soldiers led the creature into a room and shut the door.
Rico, call Jacobs and tell him we've got the prisoner secure, Beckham said. I want to have a talk with the bastard while we wait to see what Jacobs wants to do with him.
I was hoping you'd let me be part of this talk, Rico said, eyes narrowed.
Me too,
Horn said. His barreled chest expanded as he took in a deep breath.
A talk he won't forget.
Go tell Jacobs we've got him first, Beckham said.
Rico left, and Beckham started toward the room where they had the beast secured.
Wait, Kate said. I want to watch.
It's not safe, Kate, Horn said.
I need to know more about these creatures, Kate said. Besides, there's just one of him and plenty of us.
Beckham and Horn exchanged a glance.
Fine, Beckham said.
They went into the room where three soldiers had bound the beast to a chair. The Chimera glared at them with his golden eyes, blood dribbling from the corner of his mouth. His muscles tensed across his scarred body. Flat, slitted nostrils flared with each breath. The sour lemon scent of a variant drifted off his sweaty flesh. Kate had to remind herself that this twisted body contained the brain of an intelligent being.
We're going to ask you a few questions and you're going to answer, Beckham said. Nod if you understand.
Surprisingly, the beast did just that.
What in the hell were you doing outside Houston? Beckham asked.
The Chimera said nothing, pressing his thin, wormy lips tightly closed.
Hey, asshole, do you not understand English now? Horn said.
He reached into his vest and pulled out brass knuckles that he slipped over his fist.
Know what these are? Horn asked. I pulled them off a collaborator. They'll make your ugly face even uglier.
Why were you outside Houston? Beckham entreated.
The Chimera said nothing. Beckham nodded at Horn, and the big man let loose a haymaker of a punch that would have laid any normal man flat on his back. It connected with a sickening crunch that made Kate flinch, and she had to look away momentarily. When she faced the Chimera again, she saw him staring defiantly back up at Horn and Beckham. Blood gushed from the split above his eye. He hissed at them.
Why would I tell you anything?
Depends on how much pain you can endure, Horn said, shaking out his fist. Because that was just a warning shot.
Beckham tried another question.
How many other groups are out there?
Again, the Chimera didn't answer, and again Horn whacked the creature in the face. Kate cringed at the crack. The interrogation continued, but no matter how they tried to convince the half-man, half-monster to talk, he said nothing. The guards in the room watched with their rifles cradled. A knock on the door sounded, breaking Kate from her trance watching the beast, and she opened it. Commander Jacobs and Rico stepped inside with another four men.
I'll take you from here, Jacobs said.
He nodded at his men. The soldier started untying the ropes on the Chimera and placed heavy steel shackles over his limbs to prevent their prisoner from running. They prodded the Chimera to stand and forced him to shuffle toward the lobby door. Kate wasn't sure what the commander planned to do with the Chimera, but she doubted he would have any better luck.
Wait a second, sir, Kate said. I have another way we can get some information from him.
Jacobs ordered his men taking the Chimera outside to pause.
What's that, Dr. Lovato?
He might not be willing to talk, but that won't stop an analysis I can run on his tissue.
The Chimera glared at her with golden, inquisitive eyes. She decided to step into the hall to tell Jacobs her plan.
Sedate him, and let me take a few biopsies, Kate continued. I can analyze his blood and other tissues to figure out how beasts like this came into existence.
Jacobs looked back at the door, then shrugged.
Make this quick.
Kate retreated to the lab that Jacobs had set up for them on the second floor of the hospital and returned with a handful of plastic vials and needles. The creature was already out from the sedatives when she returned, but she still approached his scarred body cautiously.
Be ready for anything, Beckham said to the soldiers standing guard.
Six of the men surrounded the metal table, checking the straps around the creature's legs and arms. Beckham and Horn flanked Kate as she slowly walked up to him with her biopsy needles. She had a mask on now, but she could still smell the awful scent. After she prepared the first needle, Horn cut off the Chimera's coat and shirt, revealing his twisted body. She was amazed and sickened at the amount of work it must have taken to design such an abomination. Part of her couldn't help but feel pity for this thing. She wondered if it was more man than monster, but that was a question for another time. When she found a good spot on the arm, she jabbed a biopsy needle into the flesh. Piece by piece, she took more tissue samples, depositing them into the plastic vials. Then she used another needle and tube for a blood sample. Finding an accessible vein was no problem with the beast's vessels pushing up against his gray flesh. "That's it," she said when she finished the blood sample.
"Good job," Beckham said.
"Gross shit," Horn muttered.
She took the samples back to the laboratory. They were just small hunks of flesh and muscle and blood, but it helped inspire newfound confidence. Not only were they now capable of tapping into the new god's communications through the organic network, but she had the first usable samples of Chimera flesh. With these, she could unlock the secrets to the origins of these monsters. Maybe those revelations would even lead them to the prophet she kept hearing about on the network. Either way, Kate was certain the small plastic vials with bits of gore she held now would only improve the Allied States' chance of finally turning this war around before it was too late.
"If it's not already too late," she whispered.
6. Early morning light permeated the dense cloud cover, giving the world a slightly gray glow. Cold still seeped through Fitz's body. He fought the fatigue in his muscles and the biting cold. Thoughts of Rico helped him carry on. Hopefully Ghost would be sent south soon, and he could finally see her again. At least the snowfall had temporarily abated. The brightening sun helped him see the tracks of whoever had been following the river before them. Dohai examined the trail, while Fitz surveyed the snow between the trees. It looked as if a couple platoons had marched through here. By the looks of the prints, they were human.
"Jesus," Ace said. "Who the hell are these guys?"
"How many do you think we're dealing with?" Fitz asked.
30. Maybe more," Dohai replied coldly.
They followed the tangled tracks to a clearing in the forest that led to a frozen lake already covered in snow. Once again, Dohai was on point, but the footprints were deep enough to lead the way. Ace and Fitz followed close behind Dohai with Spearhead on the rear guard. They crossed so many intertwining trails that he figured they would have run into them by dumb luck, even if they hadn't found the first set. Fitz motioned to Dohai to pick up the pace as they continued through the forest, following all the winding paths until they reached the edge of a frozen lake. Mountains loomed beyond the lake, with pine trees covered in white, looking as if they were giant stalagmites. The trail they had been following continued over the snow-covered ice and straight toward the opposite side of the lake nearly a half mile away. Fitz and his team remained in the shadows of the trees as they surveyed their quarry. He lifted his binos to where Dohai pointed.
"My God," Fitz whispered. "Looks like we found where those bears were going."
While most of the contacts were sheltered in the forest, he estimated at least 60 or 70 that he could see, all wearing white coats or camouflage and carrying weapons. They were too far for him to tell if they were chimeras or collaborators. Between those soldiers, he saw another 24 bears. They wore giant black collars, visible against their white fur, not unlike the ones Fitz had heard the Thrall variants had worn outside Outpost Portland.
"They've come for Corrin, haven't they?" Nielsen asked. "Hell if we know," Ace said. "Maybe they're just pissed after Seattle."
Toussaint eyed them suspiciously.
"Did they follow you from there?"
"We flew," Ace said. "How would they follow us?"
"I'm sure they have their ways," Doherty said. "Or maybe this is the beginning of the invasion in the north," Dohai said.
We warned the general about this.
Doesn't matter why they're here, Fitz said. Nielsen, we should call it in.
I count 25 bears, Dohai said. Maybe 70 soldiers. But it looks like there are far more in the woods. It's hard to see from this far.
These assholes came in right during the storm, right when we pulled our scouts back, Doherty said.
Sherman leaned over to Nielsen and Fitz, then pointed to a spot just north of the enemy. Groups of soldiers looked to be checking over their weapons. Others were lining up as if getting ready to march. A pit formed in his stomach. These people looked like they were preparing to move, and he feared he knew where they were headed. Nielsen finished reporting the enemy count that Dohai had provided.
Spearhead 1, can you repeat?
Replied the comms officer back at HQ.
Command, this is Ghost 1. Hostiles are preparing to move. I repeat, preparing to move. You've got to prepare the defenses. Tell General Kamer immediately.
Roger that, Ghost 1.
Let's pick some of them off, Sherman said. We took out the bears. We can thin this herd, too.
Son, you're getting ahead of yourself, Ace said. We killed 6 bears. There's damn near an extra 20 of those beasts over there, plus how many other assholes waiting in the woods?
Want me to get closer for better numbers? Dohai asked.
No, Fitz said. We stay here for a minute. I need to think.
The most direct path to get a better view was across the open expanse of the lake. Otherwise, they would have to circle around, which Fitz estimated would take the better part of an hour or more to do without being seen. By then, the enemy might already have started their attack. Fitz would rather be helping Bant survive than be stuck out here, half buried in snow.
We're better off going back to base, Fitz said. They're going to need all the help they can get.
Somewhere across the lake, the roar of a bear shook over the ice. It was answered by several more of the bloodthirsty beasts. Maybe it was already too late.
Dohai, lead us back to base, Fitz said.
They began the trek southeast, jogging through the snow. They didn't have time to cover their tracks with how quickly the snow was falling. Fitz merely hoped they made it to base before the enemy did. His breath plumed out in an icy mist as he ran. Every step strained his already agonized muscles. They had been tracking through the woods all night, and now even the adrenaline of seeing the enemy could not assuage the exhaustion seeping through his injured body, conspiring to slow their retreat. A gunshot suddenly cracked into the night, the sound ricocheting between the trees. Fitz dropped low instinctively, his rifle rising immediately. The others sheltered behind the trees. More shots exploded from somewhere to their east, bullets punching into the wood. Bark sprayed over Fitz. Sherman cried. He fell backward into the snow. Nielsen began to crawl to him, but more bullets tore into their position. Sherman jerked from the impacts, and the snow around him began to turn red. Fitz swung his rifle around toward the gunfire. Between the shadows of the snow-covered trees, he saw 2 men, or chimeras, he couldn't be sure. All he knew was they had his team pinned down.
Dohai, cover me, Fitz commanded.
Dohai put down a blanket of suppressing fire, and Fitz hobbled to a better position, a few yards out from his team. He had a clear line of sight now into the flanks of his enemy. Both were still focused on the Canadians. Fitz opened fire. The first soldier went down with a yelp of pain. The second started to turn, but Fitz caught him too. Blood sprayed from the man as bullets riddled his side and neck. His head flipped backward as he fell into the snow, and for the first time, Fitz saw the face of the scouts who had caught up to them. His targets were monsters, but they weren't chimeras. They were men. Collaborators. More gunfire rang out somewhere just south of them. Fitz adjusted his aim and fired. Bullets pounded against the tree trunks where he spotted 3 more collaborators. They wore dingy gray and white clothes, a patchwork of military-issue uniforms and old fatigues that looked as though they had grabbed them from an apocalyptic thrift shop. One of them went down, but the other 2 ducked behind cover. Fitz couldn't get a clean shot.
Ace, flank them, he called out over the comm.
Ace acknowledged the command with a curt affirmative. Fitz trained his rifle on the three collaborators and squeezed his trigger, letting out a long burst. That gave Ace just enough time to rush to a new position between the trees. He opened fire and caught all three collaborators unaware. They crumpled into the snow, steam rising off their still forms.
Clear,
Doha yelled.
Clear,
Nielsen replied. They had killed the last of the collaborator scouts, but the short battle felt nothing like a victory. Toussaint and Nielsen knelt next to Sherman, checking his pulse, as if by some miracle he might still be alive. The vacant stare told Fitz that Sherman was gone. Nielsen started to lift Sherman with Toussaint's help when a chorus of distant howls erupted into the night. There was no time to move the man.
Run! Fitz yelled.
The odor of death still lingered in Timothy's nostrils from the brief battle in the Houston suburbs. Late morning sunlight bathed the neighborhood. He had thought that after killing those Chimera scouts, his time outside the gates of Outpost Houston was done for the day. But he was wrong. Once again, he found himself in the neighborhood where the battle had taken place with Ruckley, Wong, and Boyd. This time, they were not alone in the ruined neighborhood. Four other teams of soldiers swept the fields and parks nearby for more landmines. They might be able to risk the additional abandoned explosives, but the team wasn't here just to look for them. Their secondary mission was to search for more intel, anything that the dead Chimeras might have left behind. Most of the men had bitched about coming back out here, but Timothy thought about what would happen when the outpost was safe again and expanded back into the rest of Houston. Maybe it was too soon, but he imagined a future where he and Tasha grew up down here and raised a family. How horrific would it be if one of their children wandered into this park looking for a place to play without knowing what terrible traps were waiting just beneath the soil? Wong swept a metal detector to locate any more planted mines. Timothy, Ruckley, and Boyd covered him while he searched in silence. They hadn't slept much. Everyone was on edge because of the attack and the potential for more mines. It didn't take long for the metal detector to beep. Timothy froze, holding his breath. Wong bent down and picked up a spent shell casing, then flipped it to Boyd. The larger man stuffed it into a bag.
So many false positives, Timothy said. This is going to take forever.
Better it takes forever now than the split second when one of these explodes again on a patrol. Or a kid, Boyd said. If those variants come back, I'd rather face them knowing we found all these things instead of trying to tiptoe around hoping we don't explode.
A shout echoed across the park from near a rusted playground.
Mine,
a soldier called, marking his position with a small plastic flag. An explosive ordnance disposal, EOD team, rushed over from their position and began the delicate process of setting up a controlled explosive to detonate the mine. After they ensured everyone nearby was far enough away, the EOD team detonated the mine with a resonating thud, dirt and grass chunks puffing into the air. Wong continued waving the detector over the grass. Timothy followed cautiously, stopping when his boots slurped over a mound of what he thought was mud. He looked down to find a sticky hunk of variant flesh. Slowly, he roved his rifle over the empty houses and tall grass around the perimeter of the park. A few birds called out, their morning songs ringing in the stillness of the early morning. The humidity began to climb with the temperatures as the sun crawled into the sky. The resulting swampy smells made breathing a nasty chore. Over and over, the team found spent bullet casings and other pieces of metal detritus that had ended up buried here. When the detector beeped again for after what felt like the thousandth time, Timothy clenched up, bored but still on guard. Wong handed Boyd the detector and knelt for a better look.
Shit, I think it's mine,